2012, July 12th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 8, The Cosmological Revolution, The Depths of Space and Time. So today is the last of the five lectures trying to set the stage for this course by looking at five fundamental intellectual revolutions that really bring us up to the modern age so we can begin the discussion of life on other worlds. And today I want to focus on the culmination of the Copernican Revolution, what I call the Cosmological Revolution. It's taking the Copernican Revolution but bringing it into the 21st century and showing that what the Cosmological Revolution does is it really reveals to us the depths of space and time. What we've seen in the Geological Revolution was setting the age of the Earth. It's giving you an idea of how much deep time is involved with both the geology of the Earth and life on Earth. We have a background in which to work against of something like 3 or 4 billion years since the Earth became even minimally habitable. But the universe, it turns out, is much older than that. The actual answer looks to be about 13.8 billion years in round numbers. And so when we start considering life elsewhere, we really do have to consider that deep time extends also out to the universe, but it does not appear to be infinite. We don't have an infinite amount of time. And that may set some interesting limits for us in understanding how to address the question of life on other worlds. In particular today, what I want to do is bring you a sort of very quickly up to speed on basic modern astronomy as is relevant to us. Of course, we'll be coming to many of these topics later and looking at it in detail. Today, I just want to give the big picture view. The first fact to come away with today is that the Earth is one of only 8 planets in the solar system. There are what we call maybe 8 major planets, and we'll show you what those planets are and their properties that make them different. The Sun that all these planets circle turns out to be a middle-aged, small-mass star, which is part of a larger assemblage of stars we call the Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way itself is an assembly of 100 billion stars, as many tens of thousands of light years across, but it too is also one of many galaxies throughout the universe. Various estimates are between 10 and 100 billion galaxies throughout the visible portion of the universe that we've been able to map to date. So we've ended up with a galaxies full of hundreds of billions of stars, and there are literally hundreds of billions of galaxies to go on. There are, in round numbers, estimated between 10 to the 22 and 20 to the 23 stars within the visible universe. Furthermore, we can actually have reached the point now in our understanding of the world to know that the universe can actually be viewed itself as a physical system about which we can make simple quantitative predictions. The universe appeared to have been formed about 13.5 billion years ago in an extremely hot and dense state and has been expanding ever since. And that hot, dense initial state is what you'll often hear referred to as the Big Bang. And we'll say just a little bit about that. We're not going to go into a lot of detail in this class about cosmology, the study of the universe, because we're really concerned what goes on in these much smaller units of galaxies and stars. But the final lesson to take away from here, and this has really been shown by a lot of the work in the 20th century, is that the physical laws that we find here on Earth, that we discover in the laboratory, that we discover through mathematical investigations, apply throughout the universe. We have yet to find a place in the universe where we think different physical laws apply down here. And that's extremely important, because it means studying our home is, in fact, the appropriate starting point for studying the rest of the universe and trying to understand how life emerged, how the planet behaves, will be directly applicable to the study of other planets and the possibility of life emerging on other worlds. So bringing together all of the various pieces. So we started the section with the Copernican Revolution. Getting the Earth away from the center of the universe, being the only place of change in the universe, and setting it free, basically making it one of many planets surrounding the Sun. But the Copernican Revolution was really only the beginning. The first telescopic observations by Galileo were in the year 1609-1610, so just a little bit over 400 years ago. In those subsequent 400 years, we have vastly expanded our knowledge. By the end of the 19th century, we'd actually expanded the size of the solar system to include 2 new planets, Uranus and Neptune, that are invisible or at least barely visible to the naked eye. If you know exactly where to look, have unusually sharp vision, and it's a really dark sky, you can just see Neptune or Uranus. But you really have to know where to look. With the telescope, it's straightforward and easy. They're very distinctive. Otherwise, they just look like any other star to you in the sky. So certainly we knew that the size of the solar system was out to Neptune. We'd begun to come up with geometric measurement techniques which allowed us to measure the distances to the nearest stars, something which could not be done up until about the middle of the 19th century, and realized the stars really were very, very far away, that the nearest stars should not be measured in kilometers so much as in light years is the fundamental unit of distance. By the first half of the 20th century, we'd taken that even one step further. Our ability to measure distances and say how far away are things, how big are things, had reached the point that we'd begun to map out nearby space and find out that even the Milky Way, which appears to be this disc-shaped region of stars that we live inside of, is itself but one of many billions of galaxies that fill the universe. And furthermore, by studying those galaxies, which can be many millions of light years away, just for the first nearest by galaxy, is a little over a million light years away, 2 million light years to be more exact, was only the beginning of the neighborhood. We're literally seeing galaxies that get billions of light years away, which means we're seeing them as they were many billions of years ago. The study of these revealed something even more surprising, that the universe is not just sort of some empty space that these things live in, that space and time itself is a physical system, it is dynamic, and the universe is in fact expanding. So we've gone from a very provincial view of the world, a little over 400 years ago, that set the Earth as being the center of the universe, and finding out that we really are only a really, really tiny corner of a vastly immense physical system that exists, we now know, out to a distance of about 13.5 billion light years to the most distant things that we can see with light. So let's back up a little bit and start close to home. The first thing the Copernican Revolution did for us is to show us that we are but one of many planets in the solar system. This is the modern view of the solar system as of a few years ago. It shows 8 major planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, in the inner portions of the solar system, and then Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Their distances are not shown here to proper scale, but the size of the Sun to the size of the planets is at the proper relative scale. And so we see that the Earth, indeed, not being the center of the solar system, it isn't even close to being the biggest planet in the solar system. It is the largest, by only a small measure, of the inner terrestrial planets, the 4 rocky planets, but it doesn't hold a candle to the giants Jupiter, Saturn, and even Uranus and Neptune in the outer portions of the solar system. Furthermore, there's, in addition to these 8 planets, there's an awful lot of other junk running around in the solar system. We identify the terrestrial and gas giant planets. The gas giant planets on the outside can be divided into 2 groups, the giant gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn, and these smaller ones, which are mostly gas, but actually recently we've learned are really mostly deeply buried ices, we now refer to as the ice giants. 3 planets, and now soon to be 4 and 5, the IAU, is the International Astronomical Union, is still arguing over names, are the dwarf planets. Ceres, which is the largest of, used to be called the largest of the asteroids, and now we know the innermost of the dwarf planets, followed by Pluto, which used to be the 9th planet, but which was demoted a few years ago, when it was realized that it actually is the largest, or actually now, depending upon who you talk to, either the largest or the 2nd largest of an extensive class of small ice balls that live in the outer solar system beyond Neptune. At the time this particular picture was made, there were 3 of these dwarf planets. The 2 outermost are Pluto and Eris. There are a couple of more that have been added to that list and given names like Haumea and others. So I think the dwarf planet count is up to 6 or 7 now. I forget exactly where the IAU has left that. So this is our local spatial home. Planets which are roughly similar in properties to the Earth, but a great deal of other things as well. These are going to become relevant to us when we start looking at the question of what the other planetary systems look like around other stars. If we now step away from the scale of the planets to the scale of the planetary system, the solar system, this is a sketch showing the family of the Sun, showing the orbits of the 8 major planets. So this inner yellow box encompasses the 4 terrestrial planets, which really only live in a space. It's only about 2 astronomical units at most from the Sun. In fact, the outer edge of the orbit of Mars is about 1.5 astronomical units at the outer edge of its motion. Whereas the gas giants and the ice giants occupy a space between 5 AU from the Sun for Jupiter all the way out to almost 30 astronomical units for the orbit of Neptune. And then, of course, it goes much further beyond that roughly 40 astronomical units for Pluto. Eris, it's out around 50 or so. I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head. But we suddenly see a tremendous change in scale in the solar system, whereas most of the terrestrial planets live within the inner AU and a half, but the outer solar system now you need to measure it in tens of astronomical units. Let's take a quick close look at some of these planets. These are now NASA photographs of all of these, but shown to scale. The innermost planet is Mercury. It's pretty small. It's only got a little over 5% the mass of the Earth. Venus, here shown with a radar map that guts through the heavy cloud layer that circles the entire planet, is a near twin of the Earth. It's about 80% the mass of the Earth, and not too different in radius. It's just a little bit different density than the Earth, but a very different place. It's closer to the Sun. It's immensely hotter. We're going to study this in a little bit more detail later on when we talk about life elsewhere in the solar system. While it has a lot of properties similar to the Earth, there are some tremendous differences. There are reasons why the Earth is habitable and Venus is not. If we step out in the solar system, we actually drop down suddenly in size to the planet Mars. A lot of people don't really realize how much smaller Mars is than the Earth. It's only 1/10, or about 11%, to be more precise, of the mass of the Earth. It lives further away. It's colder. Mars is also the opposite of the Earth, where the Earth has liquid water and a breathable atmosphere. Mars has an extremely thin atmosphere that's equivalent in pressure to the atmosphere 40 kilometers in the air in the Earth, mostly carbon dioxide, and it's frozen. In fact, carbon dioxide can freeze out as snow on the Martian poles. It is a dead, dry world. So it's not a place we're likely to see life because there's no liquid water on Mars. On Venus, it's way too hot for liquid water. In fact, it has a runaway greenhouse effect, as we'll see later in the course. The surface temperature is more than 700 degrees Fahrenheit, and so water can only exist in a vapor form. And in fact, most of the water vapor has actually evaporated off of Venus, and Venus is now nearly almost bone dry. It's got a heavy, hot carbon dioxide atmosphere. So what a difference a couple of fractions of an astronomical unit make between the warm, wet Earth, hot, dry Venus, and cold, dry Mars. This is going to be an important theme we're going to pick up when we deal with life in the solar system. Is there's a very, very narrow margin around any given star where conditions like we find on the Earth actually exist. It's called the habitable zone. It'll be one of the major themes we pick up in the third unit of the course, on fourth unit of the course on life in the solar system. When we go into the outer solar system, the character of the planet suddenly changes a great deal. We go from planets like the Earth and Venus and Mars and Mercury that have solid surfaces and little, either a lot of atmosphere or virtually no atmosphere at all, to planets that are, to a first approximation, all atmosphere with no solid surfaces. These are the giant planets of the outer solar system. They basically break into two groups, the giant gas bags or gas giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, which are, in round numbers, 300 and a little under 100 times the mass of the Earth, 95 times the mass of the Earth. Those are gigantic planets. The Earth, at scale down here, would just barely be the size of that little circle I'm drawing with my laser pointer. Further out, these things are mostly made of hydrogen and helium. Further out, we find hydrogen and helium being common, but not as abundant. And in fact, the insides of Uranus and Neptune are mostly highly compressed ices. Water ice, methane ice, ammonia ice. And so we refer to these as the ice giants. We used to a long time ago. In fact, when I first started teaching at Ohio State, these were all just called the gas giants. But it's only been in the last decade or so that people realized, based on spacecraft observations and other work, that the ice giants really are fundamentally different objects. They may have a rocky core deep inside, but it's not a place you could stand in the same sense as standing here on the Earth at the bottom of the atmosphere. These heavy atmospheres make a really big difference in these planets. So these may not be places we would look for life as we understand it, but they all have a retinue of moons. Many of those moons have solid surfaces. All of those moons have solid surfaces. Some of them have water ices, ammonia ices, and other properties that make them very attractive. And we're going to find, as we go out into the solar system, that in fact, the places we might look for life elsewhere in our solar system, besides, you know, the Earth, and of course everyone wants to look on Mars, and there's a big program to do that, but there are a couple of other places that are giant moons of Jupiter and Saturn that may in fact be more promising than Mars, for reasons that we'll learn later in the course. So this just gives us a taste of what the solar system looks like now in the 21st century. The big difference from Copernicus in the age of Copernicus is these objects were points of light, or in Galileo's telescopes or later telescopes, just little round disks. We now understand these as unique, dynamic worlds. We've flown spacecraft past every planet that I've shown you here in the list. Pluto, the first of the big dwarf planets of the outer solar system, has not yet been visited. It will be visited about 2017 or so by a spacecraft called New Horizons that's on its way out there. And the giant dwarf planet, or the largest of the dwarf planets of the inner solar system, Ceres, should be visited in a few years by a spacecraft called Dawn, which is currently circling the asteroid Vesta. And we'll see a little bit about that when we start doing our tour of the solar system in a couple weeks. When we jump out to the realm of the stars, all of a sudden space becomes big and really empty. If we take the Sun is a sort of middle-sized star. Without giving you the full details, it's also a middle-aged star. We know it's at least 4.6 billion years old because that's the age of the Earth. And the planetary systems form very quickly, within a couple hundred million years of the formation of their parent star. We know from studies of the Sun and from modern studies of the development of stars through their lifetime that stars like the Sun last for about 11 or 12 billion years. So we're about halfway through the life cycle of the Sun as a stable nuclear fusion source. The nearest star, like the Sun, turns out to also be pretty close. It's about 4 1/4 light years away. It's the bright star Alpha Centauri in the southern hemisphere constellation of the Centaur. Alpha Centauri is not visible from our latitude. You have to get down around the equator before you can really see it a lot. I've seen Alpha Centauri from about 18 degrees north in Hawaii, but it's really low on the horizon. And of course, it's one of the bright stars, not the brightest star, but a bright star in the southern hemisphere sky at the right time of the year. The actual nearest star is not a Sun-like star. It's a little tiny red dwarf, probably only about 10% the mass of the Sun, called currently Proxima Centauri. Proxima, of course, for the word, it's in proximity. And it's actually not too far away. It's 4.22 light years. It's actually a third star orbiting around Alpha Centauri. Where our Sun is a single Sun surrounded by a retinue of planets, Alpha Centauri is a triple star system. There are two inner stars. We'll study these in more detail later when we talk about life in the universe, orbiting around each other fairly close. And then Proxima Centauri is a very, very much distant star further away. In fact, so close, it's basically 0.04 light years closer to us than the main star, Alpha Centauri. We do not know presently whether Alpha Centauri has a planetary system. If you have a binary star, it may make an unstable gravitational system in certain cases. And we don't really know yet. We've searched, and people are continuing to search, but as yet we know of no planets around Alpha Centauri. What's also notable here is that at this scale that I've drawn this, in which you have about 4 1/4 light years across the diagonal of the screen, all of the solar system that I've shown you would fit within the inner few pixels on this diagram. And that includes even the realm of the comets. The difference between planetary space and interstellar space is vast. And it was understanding that that distance was really large. People had a good inkling of that for a long time, but it really became clear in the late 19th century. And of course, we've proceeded to measure the distances to more and more stars as our technology has gotten better to the present day. If we expand out to about the nearest 10 or so light years around the Sun, we get to a place called the solar neighborhood. We now put the Sun in this middle, and that circle here, the yellow sphere I've drawn, is the scale of the previous drawing that I've shown you. And there are a couple of dozen stars in sort of this sphere that goes out to about 20 light years around from the Sun. What we notice about that, the colors of the stars here, places like Tau Ceti, for example, are stars that are very much like the Sun. They're similar size, similar age in round numbers, similar temperatures. What's notable is if you look within this fairly large volume of space, there are only 1, 2, 3 Sun-like stars within that volume. Most of the stars are these little red dwarfs. There's a few other stars, a couple of hot stars like Sirius and Procyon, and kind of these orangish stars that are slightly lower mass than the Sun. But stars like the Sun are relatively thin on the ground in our local solar neighborhood. If I scan out a little bit more to 100 light years, I expand my definition of neighborhood a little bit, then I start picking up a lot more stars. And there are many thousands of stars within our solar neighborhood out to about 100 light years. This volume is of interest to us because the current searches for planets around other stars are going to have having most of their success within this 100 light year volume. Some of the techniques are now beginning to reach out further than that. You'll hear a lot, for example, in the news about the Kepler mission, which is searching for planets. That's finding them beyond this 100 light year circle using a special technique called planetary transits. And work at Ohio State looking for planets is actually extending this to larger distances within our own Milky Way galaxy. But a lot of the planets we know now are pretty much within this 100 or getting up to 200 light-year volume surrounding the Sun. And when we get out there again, one notices the finite number of stars. The space is really pretty empty around this place. Finally, when we drop out all the way to 500 light-years, we're starting to get out into the realm where we're starting to now see a very large volume of stars, and now a lot of these stars are the bright stars we see. This inner circle is the previous volume. So as we begin to open up the volume around the Sun, we find we still see systems of stars surrounding us. It's only when we get out to scales of 1,000 light years that suddenly the structure of space begins to change. What we begin to see is the stars, in fact, are not kind of evenly distributed around us, but begin to fall into sort of these broad bands. And in fact, what we're starting to see is the beginnings of the large-scale structure of the Milky Way galaxy, this flattened disk of stars that we live in that's many thousands of light years across. And in fact, this particular region here is something referred to as the Orion Arm, the constellation of Orion, which you can see up in the winter sky when it isn't dark, or is nice and dark, no clouds, is out in this direction, out in here. So the whole constellation of Orion, which looks like a nice pattern of stars, is actually laid out along this fairly long distance here into one of the arms of the Milky Way galaxy. The discovery of the Milky Way galaxy was really one of the big accomplishments of the early and middle parts of the 20th century. It was very difficult to measure distances out to much beyond a few hundred light years. And so beginning to probe out into seeing what the scale of this large disk of stars really took both advances in technology and finding new ways to measure distances to get you further out. This is a combination of pictures. On the top is the view of the Milky Way galaxy from the Sun. We are inside the disk, and as we look out, we see, in fact, that most of the plane of the Milky Way is filled with dark clouds of dust that block our view. It's really kind of difficult to get the idea of a forest, when you're standing in the middle of the forest itself, because the trees and the shrubs block your view at some distance. So it's really quite tricky to get an idea of the size of the Milky Way galaxy. If I then use this information and information about distances to gas clouds and stars within our Milky Way, we can use that information to reconstruct the shape of the Milky Way galaxy if I could somehow get not in the plane where we are, but come out of the plane and look down upon it from above. And that's what this bottom picture is here. This is a computer graphic, which has been kind of duded up by the artist to look good, but otherwise is a pretty good representation of the shape of our galaxy. We live in something called a spiral galaxy. It's about 100,000 light years in diameter, and we're kind of just a little bit past halfway towards the outside of that, in between two of the spiral arms, the Scorpius and Taurus arm and the Orion arm that we see out in here. Our distance from the center of the Milky Way, we're all orbiting around the Milky Way with all the other stars, at a speed of about 200 kilometers a second, and the distance from the Sun to the center of the Milky Way is about 26,000 light years. So it gives you an idea of the sudden change of scale of the Milky Way galaxy. This is a flattened disk of stars. It contains something like 200 billion stars throughout its entire volume. So we've suddenly gone from a local neighborhood of stars that's a few hundred stars, and we realize that neighborhood really is barely out of the cosmic backyard. That we have to get out to 100,000 light years, tens of thousands of light years around the Sun, and we suddenly find that we're in another system. We're in a system of stars consisting of more than 100 billion other stars in a flattened disk rotating around a common center. Yeah, there's a question in the middle there.
Would there be any physical differences between being towards the center of the galaxy and towards the outside?
That's a very good question. What he asked was, to repeat it, was are there physical differences between being at the inner part of the galaxy and the outer part of the galaxy? There are a couple of different differences. One is that towards the center of the galaxies, there are more older stars which have higher content of metals, and there's a higher density of stars. So you'd see more stars in the sky if you were closer to the center. If you get into the very center, you get into trouble because there's about a 2 million solar mass black hole down at the middle of this, at the very middle, and you don't want to get too close to that or you're in really bad shape. Out in the spiral arms, though, it's really hard to distinguish. You would see a higher density of stars if you were in the arm. We're kind of in one of these inner arm regions now. Now, there is an interesting question which we're going to address a little bit when we get later in the course and looking at the question of habitability in the galaxy, is you have a lot more metals in the middle, very few metals on the outside. Metals meaning things like silicon, iron, nickel, things like that, are what you build planets out of. And so one idea that people are starting to ask is, maybe there is a difference in the number of planets you need metals to build them out of. In the metal-poor outskirts of the galaxy, there may be fewer rocky planets per star than there are on the inside. And we're kind of in the middle. Maybe there is, in fact, a limit. We'll talk, for example, about habitability around stars. What is the zone where you could have a solid surface with liquid water? And that sort of seems to be one of the criteria we're going to use for saying, is that star got a habitable zone? It turns out that some people think there's also a galactic habitable zone. And it is both a combination of, are there metals to build planets out of, or maybe the environment surrounding it may be harsh for some reason and actually preclude the possibility of life emerging. People have begun to think in those terms as well. So where you are in the galaxy may, in fact, influence whether or not you're in a habitable place on the larger scales. And that's a question we're going to pick up a little bit later in the class when we get a little bit more information underneath behind our belt. That's a very good question. So the Milky Way turns out to be important because for a long time, people thought the Milky Way was the universe. Now, there was other little fuzzy patches of light, but they couldn't measure the distances to them. They couldn't tell whether those fuzzy patches of light were other Milky Ways like our own or just clusters of stars inside of our own Milky Way. So this idea that the Milky Way was everything versus the Milky Way was but one of many little island universes was both a philosophical argument for many years and later became a problem of serious scientific inquiry. It was only in the beginning parts of the 20th century that we invented ways to measure distances much more than a few thousand light years and suddenly began to realize that many of these so-called nebulae, little clouds of stars, were in fact other Milky Ways, not thousands of light years, but millions of light years away. So, for example, if we go out to a million light years around the sun, and now I'm going to stop using the sun as the center. I'm going to make the center of the Milky Way because the fact that I'm here as opposed to here doesn't really make much difference anymore. The difference between 10,000 light years and a million light years starts to shrink to insignificance. It's like whether you're, it's significant that we're in this classroom on this scale, but after a while, am I in Ohio or the United States or on the Earth? Where you are on the Earth doesn't matter much. So we're going to shift our center to the center of the Milky Way. What we find is in that million light year zone, it's a pretty empty place. There's a bunch of little tiny dwarf galaxies, a few hundred million stars here and there, maybe a few billion stars in the larger structures, but mostly empty space, filled with only these little tiny islands, puddles of gravity holding together various groupings of stars. I have to go a fair bit distance away. In fact, I have to go 2.5 million light years away before I encounter another galaxy similar to the Milky Way. This, of course, turns out to be the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the nearest large galaxy to the Milky Way. It's about the same size as the Milky Way and same mass. In fact, they seem to go back and forth as to whether the Milky Way is more massive or Andromeda. It's really hard to measure the masses of galaxies. I think right now it's still tipping that the Milky Way is the number one galaxy in the local zone. So we're doing pretty good. But, you know, there could be a paper come out next week which will, you know, shove that the other way. It's about the same size as the Milky Way. It looks really big on the sky. This is actually a trick photograph, but the scale is right. The Andromeda Galaxy is a few degrees across. The full moon is about a half a degree across as viewed from the ground. Now, of course, we don't see the Andromeda like this. If you have really sharp vision and you have a really, really dark sky in the summertime, you can just barely see the Andromeda Galaxy with the naked eye. It looks like a tiny smudge that's not quite star-like. I've seen it once in the deep Sierra Nevada mountains back when I was a lot younger and not wearing these things in front of my eyes. It's easier to see in a telescope, but even in a telescope, it only appears as a bright smudge of light. It's really difficult to see. This beautiful color photograph that shows dust lanes and spiral structure takes a few hours to produce using special equipment. Now, it turns out that while, you know, the sun and all the stars in the Milky Way orbit around the center of mass of the Milky Way, Even at a distance of 2.5 million light years away, gravity is still the ruling force. The Milky Way and Andromeda are actually orbiting each other. Very slowly. We're talking about orbits now that take many billions of years to close a circle, but we're orbiting around a common center of mass. In fact, we're not even sure of the shape of the orbit. Are we orbiting in circles, or are we orbiting on a plunging orbit where we might, in fact, collide with the Andromeda galaxy in a few billion years? We actually don't know the answer to that question. There seems to be one school of thought that says we're going to collide with the Andromeda in about, I think it's about 4 billion years, 3 or 4 billion years. Another school of thought that says, no, we're moving just enough to the side that we kind of fall away from each other, and we're orbiting around a common center of mass. So we don't really know what the answer is, but we do know that, in fact, galaxies tend to clump together. And we see that we live in a neighborhood with two large galaxies, the Milky Way and Andromeda, and a whole host of smaller galaxies. We refer to, quite frankly, somewhat unimaginatively as the local group. The scale of this local group now is now on scales of 10 million light years. So we got 10 million light years shown on this computer drawing. The previous volume I showed you was the Milky Way galaxy and the retinue of little dwarfs around us is this 1 million light year sphere there. Andromeda is about 2.5 million light years away, so the big galaxy there is about the size of the Milky Way. And there's an assembly, I think we're up to about 42, 43 members of the local group. Most of them are kind of poopy little dwarf galaxies, some of which only get down to a few hundred thousand or a few million stars, whereas you've got to get up into the Milky Way and Andromeda before you get into the kind of 100, 200 billion star level. If you count up all the stars in the Milky Way and Andromeda together, it comes to about 400, 500 billion stars. You may remember that number from one of the first lectures. That's the number of Oreo cookies that have been created, you know, made by Nabisco since 1905 or whenever they started making them. So, you know, even the number of stars seems big, 400 billion, but that's kind of a, you know, century-long industrial scale. We can crank stuff out at about that scale. But it gives you an idea sort of the sheer numbers of things, but look at the sheer vastness and emptiness of the space. This is our galactic neighborhood. This is basically stepping from the realm of the galaxies out into the realm of the universe. Now, what's the Milky Way? Well, we can look out to other galaxies, these other nebulae, and what we find is the Milky Way is really just one of a type of galaxies called spiral galaxies. It's called a spiral galaxy because of its shape. It sort of makes this little pinwheel shape of stars with relatively fewer stars in between. But what we find as we go out further and further using our ways of measuring distances, deep digital cameras to image most of the sky, try to get down to fainter and fainter and more distant objects, is we've begun to do a census of the entire universe. And we found in the last few years that there appear to be hundreds of billions of galaxies about the size of the Milky Way or smaller throughout the entire universe. What a galaxy is a vast assembly of stars that's held and gas that are held together by gravity. And there are two basic kinds of galaxies. Spiral galaxies, which have a lot of blue light in them, a lot of gas, they're sites of the formation of brand new stars. We call them star-forming galaxies. The Milky Way is like that as well. Our sun formed 4.5 billion years ago. We can look around us in the nearby Milky Way, and we can see places where stars are forming right now. In fact, stars are forming even as we speak. There are much older galaxies called elliptical galaxies that are old and dead. They've consumed most of their gas to form stars. They're not forming new stars, or certainly not appreciably. And they may have formed their last stars in some of these many billions of years ago. So when we start looking at the bigger picture of life elsewhere in the universe, the type of galaxy you're in may in fact have an influence. An old elliptical galaxy would be a place for looking for very old life, perhaps, because the stars in them formed a very long time ago, perhaps as many as 8 or 9 billion years ago. Whereas in Milky Way-like galaxies or Andromeda-like galaxies, you have new stars forming, and we know that some of the most active periods of planets turn out to be relatively early in their lifetimes. In the first few billion years is where a lot of the action of evolution appears to occur. So this may have an interesting influence on this question of life in the universe. So inside the solar system, the standard unit is a planet surrounding its star. Inside of the galaxy, the standard unit is a star, which may carry a system of planets with it. But when we step out to the scale of the universe, the unit becomes the galaxy. So as there are 100 billion stars in a typical-sized galaxy, there may be 100 billion galaxies filling an entire universe. These galaxies actually can begin to organize into some very, very large structures. We're a relatively small group. We've got two bright galaxies, Milky Way and Andromeda. But we're actually a pretty poor neighborhood as these things go. The really rich, high population centers are these groups, clusters, and superclusters of galaxies. These are now getting into structures that can be many tens of millions of light years across, that can contain many hundreds of galaxies. The very largest structures we see are as many as 100 million light years across. These are actually clusters of clusters. So we have an interesting insight here. We've begun to learn over the last few decades that you don't just simply have a galaxy anywhere you want. Galaxies tend to be found relatively near other galaxies, with vast empty voids in between these large clusters and superclusters. So the universe itself actually has a structure. That structure appears to top out at about between 100 and 300 million light years in scale. Beyond that, the universe now no longer looks like a uniform spray of stuff, but actually becomes almost foamy in appearance. So let's take a look out. Here's 200 million light years. This is in the local supercluster, as we call it. We're down here in the center, so that little circle of the local group is where the bright galaxies, that pixel there is a representation of the Milky Way, that pixel's a representation of Andromeda. If we then expand outwards, what we find is there are not galaxies in all directions, but the galaxies tend to come in clumps along this kind of long filamentary-like structure. And they tend to be organized into very large groups and eventually into very large clusters. Nearby, there's a couple of very large clusters, one near the constellation of Virgo, the other near a southern constellations of Fornax and Eridanus. So most of the galaxies are found in the company of other galaxies. They're gregarious. They like to hang together like birds in a flock. And with it, there are vast empty spaces between them. If we expand our scale out even further to a billion light years, we find now that the structure of the universe becomes very foamy. There's lots of bumps now. This circle, the yellow circle and sphere in the middle, holds the local supercluster, and we see, in fact, that is but part of one of a larger network of structures composed themselves of superclusters. We're looking at millions upon millions of galaxies represented in this plot. But when you step back and look at it, space becomes kind of foamy. There are broad walls, there are broad filaments, surrounded by tremendous deep voids where there's literally nothing inside of them. Probably not even a few handfuls of stars. So now we're getting out to the edges of this volume. It takes light to get from the edge of this picture down to the Milky Way a half a billion years. So the light we're looking at from galaxies at the edge of this volume left their parent galaxies 500 million years ago. That was before even the first dinosaurs walked upon the Earth. And it's giving you some idea of the scale of the universe. So how far does this scale go? The answer appears to be a structure, the largest structure that we can see, the last thing we can see. Here shown now not in visible light, but in the light of microwaves. The very faint heat coming off of the earliest phases of the Big Bang goes back to one last surface at just the instant the universe went from a hot, opaque fireball to the thin, clear, open space that we see today, approximately 13.5 billion years ago. And so the size of this structure from one sky to another, this is now wrapping the entire sky around. Blue regions are cold, red regions are hot in this representation, although the differences in temperatures in this surface are measured in microkelvins. So this is very, very small differences in temperatures. The actual gas we're seeing here today is only 3 degrees above absolute zero. This is extremely cold gas, and we're looking at tiny fluctuations in that temperature at a scale of a part in 100,000 in round numbers. The scale of this from that side of the sky to that side of the sky where I can no longer see with light is 27 billion light years. So from here to that edge is about 13.5 billion years to the surface beyond which the universe becomes opaque and it becomes a fog of radiation and electrons, and I can no longer see further. I have to infer what's going on from the physical properties of this mottled fog that we see in the great distance. So this is the visible portion of our universe. We may, in fact, live in a universe that is infinite in extent, but we can only see as far back as there is enough time for light to travel to us from that distance. And so when we say we can see out to about 13.5 billion years, that's telling us something about the age of the universe. So where does this age of 13.5 billion years come from? What sets that limit? Well, the answer turns out, if we turn the clock back a little bit to about 1929, an astronomer by the name of Edwin Hubble, for whom the Hubble Space Telescope was named many years later, discovered that the distance, that the speed with which galaxies appear to be moving through space was a strong function of how far away they were from us. The further a galaxy is, the faster it appears to be moving away from us. And it's very systematic. This red line is a fit to the scatter of points. Now, by today, when we've learned how to make better measurements and learned how to take into account the orbital motions of things around other galaxies around other galaxies within the nearby universe, this line tightens up a great deal. And what we find is there is a systematic expansion of the universe. What's happening is the further a galaxy gets from us, the faster it appears to be moving away from us. This is a very surprising result, because what it means is that what Hubble discovered was that the entire universe is in fact expanding. So in an earlier time, the universe is smaller and the galaxies are closer together. We go to a later time, the whole space has inflated and the galaxies are riding on top of it, like little pennies glued to the surface of an inflating balloon. So the further away the galaxy is from us, from here in the center, we're looking at something on the surface of this sphere, all these galaxies appear to be moving far away. If I'm sitting on this galaxy, these three galaxies are all further away than they were originally. If I'm sitting on this central galaxy, these other three galaxies appear closer and then later begin further away. There's no center to this expansion because we're all riding on the surface of the sphere. Well, this is a representation of this expansion of the universe. To do this in real space, you've got to do this in four dimensions, and that makes my brain hurt. So we'll just make this a very simple type of picture. The idea is that the universe is steadily expanding. It's inflating over time, which means we can also turn the clock backwards. If we go back in time, we see the universe when it was smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually you're going to reach the point that the universe basically is so small that it becomes hot and dense, just like any kind of compression of gas. And so what happens is you can run the clock backwards, but only so far, before you find the universe is not filled with stars and gas. It's filled only with hot gas. And that gas gets hotter and denser until finally you're as hot as the surface of the sun. Then you're as hot as the core of the sun. Then you're as hot as the center of a nuclear reaction. And you run it back in time, and you reach this initial, very hot, very dense initial state, which we call somewhat fancifully the Big Bang. What the Big Bang really is just a fanciful name for saying there's an initial, very hot, very dense state to the universe that I can extrapolate backwards to from the present day observed expansion of the universe. Our best current measurements are giving us an age of the universe, the time in which this initial hot, dense state occurred was 13.5 billion years ago. So this is giving us an idea, a measurement of the age of the universe. So we don't live in an infinitely old universe. There is a definite beginning to the universe. Our best measurements place that beginning 13.5 billion years ago. So like the age of the Earth brackets the appearance of life and emergence of life on Earth, so too the age of the universe is going to bracket the emergence of life within the universe. It's not infinitely old, it's actually finite age. And that may set some limits on how much time there is for life to have emerged. A much older universe will have had more time and perhaps be more populated than a young universe. That's purely a speculation, but that's one possible implication of an age of the universe for this course. So to summarize, I've obviously gone over a couple hundred years of science really fast. But the basic takeaway points of this are that the cosmological revolution has revealed to us the tremendous depths of time and the tremendous depths of space that the universe has to work with. We're not dealing with things happening within an instant. There's a lot of time and there's a lot of space to work with, which means a lot of possibilities. The basic lessons we've learned are as follows. The Earth and Sun are not at a special place in the universe. The fact that there's life on Earth, the fact that we're circling a fairly hospitable star, is not a unique condition. This condition may be expected to be replicated many billions of times over, or hundreds of billions of times, not only throughout the nearby space of the universe. The universe is extremely vast in size and very, very old, but we are young. We're only 4 billion years old. That's going to be an important clue to understanding what's going on with life. We look out at what the universe is made of. Everywhere we look, we see the same stuff around us. There's no exotic matter, no exotic elements elsewhere in the universe. We see hydrogen, helium, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen. The basic units of life are abundant throughout the entire universe. So if we study life with these building blocks, it may give us important clues. And finally, a lesson I've repeated over and over again, as we look out to the great depths of the universe, we find the universe is ruled by the same physical laws we discover here on Earth. And that means the physical processes that make life possible here on Earth should be repeated elsewhere over and over again through the universe. So it really is sensible to ask the question, is there life elsewhere? And what we're going to be looking at for the rest of this course is how we go about trying to answer that question. Any questions from today? Okay, with all that, I will see you tomorrow. We'll start in.